sat at my table and slept under my roof goes from my house to his own, and is struck down within an hour of his leaving my house. I cannot say but that he may have been followed from my house, watched at my house, even first marked because of his association with my house, which may have suggested his possessing greater wealth and being altogether of greater importance than his own retiring demeanour would have indicated. If I cannot, with my means and influence and my position, bring all the perpetrators of such a crime to light, I fail in the assertion of my respect for that gentleman's memory, and of my fidelity towards one who was ever faithful to me.
While he makes this protestation with great emotion and earnestness, looking round the room as if he were addressing an assembly, Mr. Bucket glances at him with an observant gravity in which there might be, but for the audacity of the thought, a touch of compassion.
"The ceremony of today," continues Sir Leicester, "strikingly illustrative of the respect in which my deceased friend," he lays a stress upon the word, for death levels all distinctions, "was held by the flower of the land, has, I say, aggravated the shock I have received from this most horrible and audacious crime. If it were my brother who had committed it, I would not spare him."
Mr. Bucket looks very grave. Volumnia remarks of the deceased that he was the trustiest and dearest person. "You must feel it as a deprivation to you, miss," replies Mr. Bucket soothingly. "No doubt. He was calculated to be a deprivation. I'm sure he was." Volumnia gives Mr. Bucket to understand in reply that her sensitive mind is fully made up never to get the better of it as long as she lives, that her nerves are unstrung for ever, and that she has not the least expectation of ever smiling again. Meanwhile she folds up a cocked hat for that redoubtable old general at Bath, descriptive of her melancholy condition.
"It gives a start to a delicate female," says Mr. Bucket, sympathetically, "but it'll wear off."
Volumnia wishes of all things to know what is doing, whether they are going to convict, or whatever it is, that dreadful soldier, whether he had any accomplices, or whatever the thing is called in the law, and a great deal more to the like artless purpose.
"Why, you see, miss," returns Mr. Bucket,
bringing the finger into persuasive action, and such is his natural gallantry that he had almost said, "my dear,"
"it ain't easy to answer those questions at the present moment. Not at the present moment. I've kept myself on this case, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," whom Mr. Bucket takes into the conversation in right of his importance, "morning, noon, and night. But for a glass or two of sherry, I don't think I could have had my mind so much upon the stretch as it has been. I could answer your questions, miss, but duty forbids it. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, will very soon be made acquainted with all that has been traced, and I hope that he may find it," Mr. Bucket again looks grave, "to his satisfaction." The debilitated cousin only hopes some flirl be executed. Example, thinks more interests wanted, get man hanged present time, than get man placed 10,000 a year. Hasn't a doubt, example, far better hang wrong fleur than no fleur.
"You know life, you know, sir," says Mr. Bucket, with a complimentary twinkle of his eye and crook of his finger, "and you can confirm what I've mentioned to this lady. You don't want to be told that from information I've received I've gone to work. You're up to what a lady can't be expected to be up to. Lord, especially in your elevated station of society, miss," says Mr. Bucket, quite reddening at another narrow escape from "my dear."
"The officer, Volumnia," observes Sir Leicester, "is faithful to his duty, and perfectly right."
Mr. Bucket murmurs, "Glad to have the honour of your approbation, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet."
"In fact, Volumnia," proceeds Sir Leicester, "it is not holding up a good model for imitation to ask the officer any such questions as you have put to him. He is the best judge of his own responsibility. He acts upon his own responsibility. And it does not become us, who assist in making the laws, to impede or interfere with those who carry them into execution. Or," says Sir Leicester somewhat sternly, for Volumnia was going to cut in before he had rounded his sentence, "or who vindicate their outraged majesty."
Volumnia with all humility explains that she had not merely the plea of curiosity to urge, in common with the giddy youth of her sex in general, but that she is perfectly dying with regret and interest for the darling man whose loss they all deplore.
"Very well, Volumnia," returned Sir Leicester. "Then you cannot be too discreet."
Mr. Bucket takes the opportunity of a pause to be heard again. "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I have no objections to telling this lady, with your leave and among ourselves, that I look upon the case as pretty well complete. It is a beautiful case, and what little is wanting to complete it, I expect to be able to supply in a few hours."
"I'm very glad to hear it," says Sir Leicester. "Highly creditable to you."
"Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," returns Mr. Bucket very seriously, "I hope it may at one and the same time do me credit and prove satisfactory to all, when I depict it as a beautiful case, you see, miss," Mr. Bucket goes on, glancing gravely at Sir Leicester, "I mean from my point of view. As considered from other points of view, such cases will always involve more or less unpleasantness. Very strange things comes to our knowledge in families, miss. Bless your heart, what you would think to be phenomenons, quite." Volumnia, with her innocent little scream, supposes so. "Aye, and even in genteel families, in high families, in great families," says Mr. Bucket, again gravely eyeing Sir Leicester aside. "I have had the honour of being employed in high families before, and you have no idea. Come, I'll go so far as to say not even you have any idea, sir," this to the debilitated cousin, "what games goes on." The cousin, who has been casting sofa pillows on his head in a prostration of boredom, yawns,
"Verily,"
being the used up for "very likely." Sir Leicester, deeming it time to dismiss the officer, here majestically interposes with the words,
"Very good, thank you,"
and also with a wave of his hand, implying not only that there is an end of the discourse, but that if high families fall into low habits, they must take the consequences.
"You will not forget, officer," he adds with condescension, "that I am at your disposal when you please."
Mr. Bucket, still grave, inquires if tomorrow morning now would suit, in case he should be as forward as he expects to be. Sir Leicester replies,
"All times are alike to me."
Mr. Bucket makes his three bows, and is withdrawing when a forgotten point occurs to him. "Might I ask, by the by," he says in a low voice, cautiously returning, "who posted the reward bill on the staircase?"
"I ordered it to be put up there," replies Sir Leicester.
"Would it be considered a liberty, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, if I was to ask you why?"
"Not at all. I chose it as a conspicuous part of the house. I think it cannot be too prominently kept before the whole establishment. I wish my people to be impressed with the enormity of the crime, the determination to punish it, and the hopelessness of escape. At the same time, officer, if you, in your better knowledge of the subject, see any objection—"
Mr. Bucket sees none now. The bill having been put up had better not be taken down. Repeating his three bows, he withdraws, closing the door on Volumnia's little scream, which is preliminary to her remarking that that charmingly horrible person is a perfect blue chamber. In his fondness for society and his adaptability to all grades, Mr. Bucket is presently standing before the hall fire, bright and warm on the early winter night, admiring Mercury.
"Why, you're 6'2", I suppose," says Mr. Bucket.
"3",
says Mercury.
"Are you so much?
But then, you see, you're broad in proportion and don't look it. You're not one of the weak-legged ones, you ain't.
Was you ever modelled now?" Mr. Bucket asks, conveying the expression of an artist into the turn of his eye and head. Mercury never was modelled.
"Then you ought to be, you know," says Mr. Bucket. "And a friend of mine that you'll hear of one day as a Royal Academy sculptor would stand something handsome to make a drawing of your proportions for the marble. My lady's out, ain't she?"
"Out to dinner."
"Goes out pretty well every day, don't she?"
"Yes."
"Not to be wondered at," says Mr. Bucket. "Such a fine woman as her, so handsome and so graceful and so elegant, is like a fresh lemon on a dinner table, ornamental wherever she goes. Was your father in the same way of life as yourself?"
Answer in the negative.
"Mine was," says Mr. Bucket. "My father was first a page, then a footman, then a butler, then a steward, then an innkeeper. Lived universally respected and died lamented. Said with his last breath that he considered service the most honourable part of his career. So it was. I've a brother in service, and a brother-in-law. My lady, a good temper?"
Mercury replies,
"As good as you can expect."
"Ah,
says Mr. Bucket. "A little spoilt? A little capricious? Lord, what can you anticipate when they're so handsome as that? And we like them all the better for it, don't we?" Mercury, with his hands in the pockets of his bright peach-blossom small clothes, stretches his symmetrical silk legs with the air of a man of gallantry, and can't deny it. Come the roll of wheels and a violent ringing at the bell. "Talk of the angels," says Mr. Bucket. "Here she is." The doors are thrown open, and she passes through the hall. Still very pale, she is dressed in slight mourning and wears two beautiful bracelets. Either their beauty or the beauty of her arms is particularly attractive to Mr. Bucket. He looks at them with an eager eye and rattles something in his pocket. Halfpence, perhaps. Noticing him at his distance, she turns an inquiring look on the other Mercury who has brought her home. "Mr. Bucket, my lady." Mr. Bucket makes a leg and comes forward, passing his familiar demon over the region of his mouth.
"Are you waiting to see Sir Leicester?"
"No, my lady, I've seen him."
"Have you anything to say to me?"
"Not just at present, my lady."
"Have you made any new discoveries?"
"A few, my lady." This is merely in passing. She scarcely makes a stop and sweeps upstairs alone. Mr. Bucket, moving towards the staircase foot, watches her as she goes up the steps the old man came down to his grave, past murderous groups of statuary, repeated with their shadowy weapons on the wall, past the printed bill, which she looks at going by out of view. "She's a lovely woman, too, she really is," says Mr. Bucket, coming back to Mercury. "Don't look quite healthy, though." "Is not quite healthy," Mercury informs him. "Suffers much from headaches."
"Really? That's a pity. Walking, Mr. Bucket would recommend for that."
"Well, she tries walking," Mercury rejoins. "Walks sometimes for 2 hours when she has them bad. By night, too."
"Are you sure you're quite so much as 6'3"? Asks Mr. Bucket. "Begging your pardon for interrupting you a moment."
"Not a doubt about it."
"You're so well put together that I shouldn't have thought it. But the household troops, though considered fine men, are built so straggling. Walks by night, does she? When it's moonlight, though?"
"Oh, yes. When it's moonlight. Of course.
Oh, of course."
Conversational and acquiescent on both sides.
"I suppose you ain't in the habit of walking yourself," says Mr. Bucket. "Not much time for it, I should say."
Besides which, Mercury don't like it. Prefers carriage exercise.
"To be sure," says Mr. Bucket. "That makes a difference. Now I think of it," says Mr. Bucket, warming his hands and looking pleasantly at the blaze. "She went out walking the very night of this business."
"To be sure she did. I led her into the garden over the way."
"And left her there. Certainly you did. I saw you doing it."
"I didn't see you," says Mercury.
"I was rather in a hurry," returns Mr. Bucket, "for I was going to visit an aunt of mine that lives at Chelsea, next door but two to the old original bun house. 90-year-old the old lady is, single woman, got a little property. Yes, I chanced to be passing at the time. Let's see, what time might it be? It wasn't 10.
9:30.
"You're right, so it was. And if I don't deceive myself, my lady was muffled in a loose black mantle with a deep fringe to it."
"Of course she was.
Of course she was."
Mr. Bucket must return to a little work he has to get on with upstairs. But he must shake hands with Mercury, in acknowledgement of his agreeable conversation, and will he, this is all he asks, will he, when he has a leisure half-hour, think of bestowing it on that Royal Academy sculptor for the advantage of both parties? Chapter 54 Springing a Mine. Refreshed by sleep, Mr. Bucket rises betimes in the morning and prepares for a field day. Smartened up by the aid of a clean shirt and a wet hairbrush, with which instrument on occasions of ceremony he lubricates such thin locks as remain to him after his life of severe study, Mr. Bucket lays in a breakfast of 2 mutton chops as a foundation to work upon, together with tea, eggs, toast, and marmalade on a corresponding scale. Having much enjoyed these strengthening matters and having held subtle conference with his familiar demon, he confidently instructs Mercury, "Just to mention quietly to Celeste Dedlock, Baronet, that whenever he's ready for me, I'm ready for him." A gracious message being returned that Celeste will expedite his dressing and join Mr. Bucket in the library within 10 minutes, Mr. Bucket repairs to that apartment and stands before the fire with his finger on his chin, looking at the blazing coals. Thoughtful Mr. Bucket is, as a man may be with weighty work to do, but composed, sure, confident. From the expression on his face he might be a famous whist player for a large stake, say 100 guineas, certain, with a game in his hand, but with a high reputation involved in his playing his hand out to the last card in a masterly way. Not in the least anxious or disturbed is Mr. Bucket when Sir Leicester appears, but he eyes the baronet aside as he comes slowly to his easy chair with that observant gravity of yesterday in which there might have been yesterday, but for the audacity of the idea, a touch of compassion.
"I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, officer, but I am rather later than my usual hour this morning. I'm not well. The agitation and the indignation from which I have recently suffered have been too much for me. I am subject to gout."
Sir Leicester was going to say indisposition and would have said it to anybody else, but Mr. Bucket palpably knows all about it.
"And recent circumstances have brought it on."
As he takes his seat with some difficulty, and with an air of pain, Mr. Bucket draws a little nearer, standing with one of his large hands on the library table.
"I'm not aware, officer,"
Sir Leicester observes, raising his eyes to his face,
"whether you wish us to be alone, but that is entirely as you please. If you do, well and good. If not, Miss Dedlock would be interested."
"Why, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," returns Mr. Bucket, with his head persuasively on one side and his forefinger pendant at one ear like an earring, "we can't be too private just at present. You will presently see that we can't be too private. A lady, under the circumstances, and especially in Miss Dedlock's elevated station of society, can't but be agreeable to me. But speaking without a view to myself, I will take the liberty of assuring you that I know we can't be too private."
"That is enough."
"So much so, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," Mr. Bucket resumes, "that I was on the point of asking your permission to turn the key in the door."
"By all means."
Mr. Bucket skilfully and softly takes that precaution, stooping on his knee for a moment from mere force of habit, so to adjust the key in the lock as that no one shall peep in from the outer side.
"Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I mentioned yesterday evening that I wanted but a very little to complete this case. I have now completed it, and collected proof against the person who did this crime."
"Against the soldier?"
"No, Sir Leicester Dedlock, not the soldier."
Sir Leicester looks astounded and inquires,
"Is the man in custody?"
Mr. Bucket tells him, after a pause, "It was a woman." Sir Leicester leans back in his chair and breathlessly ejaculates,
"Good heaven!"
"Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," Mr. Bucket begins, standing over him with one hand spread out on the library table and the forefinger of the other in impressive use, "it's my duty to prepare you for a train of circumstances that may, and I go so far as to say that will, give you a shock. But, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, you are a gentleman, and I know what a gentleman is and what a gentleman is capable of. A gentleman can bear a shock, when it must come, boldly and steadily. A gentleman can make up his mind to stand up against almost any blow. Why, take yourself, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. If there's a blow to be inflicted on you, you naturally think of your family. You ask yourself, how would all them ancestors of yours, away to Julius Caesar, not to go beyond him at present, have borne that blow? You remember scores of them that would have borne it well, and you bear it well on their accounts and to maintain the family credit. That's the way you argue, and that's the way you act, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet."
Sir Leicester, leaning back in his chair and grasping the elbows, sits looking at him with a stony face.
"Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock," proceeds Mr. Bucket, "thus preparing you, let me beg of you not to trouble your mind for a moment as to anything having come to my knowledge. I know so much about so many characters, high and low, that a piece of information, more or less, don't signify a straw. I don't suppose there's a move on the board that would surprise me, and as to this or that move having taken place, why, my knowing it is no odds at all, any possible move whatever, provided it's in the wrong direction, being a probable move according to my experience. Therefore, what I say to you, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, is don't you go and let yourself be put out of the way because of my knowing anything of your family affairs."
"Well, thank you for your preparation,"
returns Sir Leicester after a silence, without moving hand, foot, or feature.
"Which I hope is not necessary, though I give it credit for being well-intended. Be so good as to go on. Also,"
Sir Leicester seems to shrink in the shadow of his figure,
"also to take a seat, if you have no objection."
None at all. Mr. Bucket brings a chair and diminishes his shadow.
"Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet,
with this short preface, I come to the point. Lady Dedlock. Sir Leicester raises himself in his seat and stares at him fiercely. Mr. Bucket brings the finger into play as an emollient. Lady Dedlock. You see, she's universally admired. That's what her ladyship is. She's universally admired, says Mr. Bucket.
I would greatly prefer, officer, Sir Leicester returns stiffly, my lady's name being entirely omitted from this discussion.
So would I, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, but it's impossible.
Impossible?
Mr. Bucket shakes his relentless head. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, it's altogether impossible. What I've got to say is about her ladyship. She is the pivot it all turns on.
Officer, retorts Sir Leicester with a fiery eye and a quivering lip, you know your duty. Do your duty, but be careful not to overstep it. I would not suffer it. I would not endure it. You bring my lady's name into this communication upon your responsibility. Upon your responsibility. My lady's name is not a name for common persons to trifle with.
Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I say what I must say and no more.
I hope it may prove so. Very well, go on, sir.
Glancing at the angry eyes which now avoid him, and at the angry figure trembling from head to foot, yet striving to be still, Mr. Bucket feels his way with his forefinger, and in a low voice proceeds, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, it becomes my duty to tell you that the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn long entertained mistrusts and suspicions of Lady Dedlock.
If he had dared to breathe them to me, sir, which he never did, I would have killed him myself,
exclaims Sir Leicester, striking his hand upon the table. But in the very heat and fury of the act, he stops, fixed by the knowing eyes of Mr. Bucket, whose forefinger is slowly going, and who, with mingled confidence and patience, shakes his head. Sir Leicester Dedlock, the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn was deep and close, and what he fully had in his mind in the very beginning I can't quite take upon myself to say, but I know from his lips that he long ago suspected Lady Dedlock of having discovered, through the sight of some handwriting, in this very house, and when you yourself, Sir Leicester Dedlock, were present, the existence, in great poverty, of a certain person who had been her lover before you courted her, and who ought to have been her husband. Mr. Bucket stops, and deliberately repeats, ought to have been her husband, not a doubt about it. I know from his lips that when that person soon afterwards died, he suspected Lady Dedlock of visiting his wretched lodging and his wretched grave alone and in secret. I know from my own inquiries, and through my eyes and ears, that Lady Dedlock did make such visit in the dress of her own maid, for the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn employed me to reckon up her ladyship, if you'll excuse my making use of the term we commonly employ, and I reckoned her up so far completely. I confronted the maid in the chambers in Lincoln's Inn Fields with a witness who had been Lady Dedlock's guide, and there couldn't be the shadow of a doubt that she had worn the young woman's dress unknown to her. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I did endeavour to pave the way a little towards these unpleasant disclosures yesterday, by saying that very strange things happened even in high families sometimes. All this, and more, has happened in your own family, and to and through your own lady. It's my belief that the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn followed up these inquiries to the hour of his death, and that he and Lady Dedlock even had bad blood between them upon the matter that very night. Now only you put that to Lady Dedlock, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and ask her ladyship whether, even after he had left here, she didn't go down to his chambers with the intention of saying something further to him, dressed in a loose black mantle with a deep fringe to it. Sir Leicester sits like a statue, gazing at the cruel finger that is probing the lifeblood of his heart. You put that to her ladyship, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, from me, Inspector Bucket of the Detective. And if her ladyship makes any difficulty about admitting of it, you tell her that it's no use, that Inspector Bucket knows it, and knows that she passed the soldier, as you called him, though he's not in the army now, and knows that she knows she passed him on the staircase. Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, why do I relate all this? Sir Leicester, who has covered his face with his hands, uttering a single groan, requests him to pause for a moment. By and by he takes his hands away, and so preserves his dignity and outward calmness, though there is no more colour in his face than in his white hair, that Mr. Bucket is a little awed by him. Something frozen and fixed is upon his manner, over and above its usual shell of haughtiness,
and Mr. Bucket soon detects an unusual slowness in his speech, with now and then a curious trouble in beginning which occasions him to utter inarticulate sounds. With such sounds he now breaks silence soon, however, controlling himself to say that he does not comprehend why a gentleman so faithful and zealous as the late Mr. Tulkinghorn should have communicated to him nothing of this painful, this distressing, this unlooked-for, this overwhelming, this incredible intelligence. "Again, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," returns Mr. Bucket, "put it to her ladyship to clear that up. Put it to her ladyship, if you think it right, from Inspector Bucket of the Detective. You'll find, or are much mistaken, that the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn had the intention of communicating the whole to you as soon as he considered it right, and further, that he had given her ladyship so to understand. Why, he might have been going to reveal it the very morning when I examined the body. You don't know what I'm going to say and do 5 minutes from this present time, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and supposing I was to be picked off now, you might wonder why I hadn't done it, don't you see?" "True." Sir Leicester, avoiding with some trouble those obtrusive sounds, says, "True." At this juncture, a considerable noise of voices is heard in the hall. Mr. Bucket, after listening, goes to the library door, softly unlocks and opens it, and listens again. Then he draws in his head and whispers hurriedly but composedly, "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, this unfortunate family affair has taken air, as I expected it might, the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn being cut down so sudden. The chance to hush it is to let in these people now in a wrangle with your footmen. Would you mind sitting quiet on the family account while I reckon them up? And would you just throw in a nod when I seem to ask you for it?" Sir Leicester indistinctly answers, "Officer, the best you can, the best you can." And Mr. Bucket, with a nod and a sagacious crook of the forefinger, slips down into the hall where the voices quickly die away. He is not long in returning, a few paces ahead of Mercury and a brother deity, also powdered and in peach-blossomed smalls, who bear between them a chair in which is an incapable old man. Another man and two women come behind. Directing the pitching of the affair in an affable and easy manner, Mr. Bucket dismisses the Mercuries and locks the door again. Sir Leicester looks on at this invasion of the sacred precincts with an icy stare.
"Now, perhaps you may know me, ladies and gentlemen," says Mr. Bucket in a confidential voice. "I am Inspector Bucket of the Detective, I am. And this," producing the tip of his convenient little staff from his breast pocket, "is my authority. Now, you wanted to see Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. Well, you do see him, and mind you, it ain't everyone as is admitted to that honour. Your name, old gentleman, is Smallweed. That's what your name is. I know it well."
"Well, and you never heard any harm of it?"
cries Mr. Smallweed in a shrill, loud voice.
"You don't happen to know why they killed the pig, do you?" retorts Mr. Bucket, with a steadfast look, but without loss of temper.
"No."
"Why, they killed him," says Mr. Bucket, "on account of his having so much cheek. Don't you get into the same position, because it isn't worthy of you. You ain't in the habit of conversing with a deaf person, are you?"
"Yes,"
snarls Mr. Smallweed.
"My wife's deaf."
"That accounts for your pitching your voice so high. But as she ain't here, just pitch it an octave or two lower, will you? And I'll not only be obliged to you, but it'll do you more credit," says Mr. Bucket. "This other gentleman is in the preaching line, I think?"
"Name of Chadband,"
Mr. Smallweed puts in, speaking henceforth in a much lower key.
"Once had a friend and brother sergeant of the same name," says Mr. Bucket, offering his hand, "and consequently feel a liking for it. Mrs. Chadband, no doubt?"
"And Mrs. Snagsby,"
Mr. Smallweed introduces.
"Husband, a law stationer, and a friend of my own," says Mr. Bucket. "Love him like a brother. Now, what's up?"
"Do you mean what business have we come upon?"
Mr. Smallweed asks, a little dashed by the suddenness of this turn.
"Ah, you know what I mean. Let us hear what it's all about in presence of Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. Come."
Mr. Smallweed, beckoning Mr. Chadband, takes a moment's counsel with him in a whisper. Mr. Chadband, expressing a considerable amount of oil from the pores of his forehead and the palms of his hands, says aloud,
"Yes, you first,"
and retires to his former place.
"I was the client and friend of Mr. Tulkinghorn,"
pipes Grandfather Smallweed then.
"I did business with him. I was useful to him, and he was useful to me. Crook, dead and gone, was my brother-in-law. He was own brother to a Brimston magpie, leastways Mrs. Smallweed. I come into Crook's property. I examined all his papers and all his effects. They was all dug out under my eyes. There was a bundle of letters belonging to a dead and gone lodger as was hid away at the back of a shelf in the side of Lady Jane's bed, his cat's bed. He hid all manner of things away, everywheres. Mr. Tulkinghorn wanted 'em, and got 'em. But I looked 'em over first. I'm a man of business, and I took a squint at 'em. They was letters from the lodger's sweetheart, and she signed Honoria. Dear me, that's not a common name, Honoria, is it? There's no lady in this house that signs Honoria, is there? Oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, no, I don't think so. And not in the same hand, perhaps. Well, no, I don't think so.
Here Mr. Smallweed, seized with a fit of coughing in the midst of his triumph, breaks off to ejaculate,
"Oh, dear me! Oh, Lord, I'm shaken all to pieces!"
"Now, when you're ready," says Mr. Bucket, after awaiting his recovery, "to come to anything that concerns Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. Here the gentleman sits, you know."
"Haven't I come to it, Mr. Bucket?" cries Grandfather Smallweed. "Isn't the gentleman concerned yet? Not with Captain Horden and his ever-affectionate Honoria? And their child into the bargain. Come, then, I want to know where those letters are. That concerns me, if it don't concern Sir Leicester Dedlock. I will know where they are. I won't have 'em disappear so quietly. I handed 'em over to my friend and solicitor, Mr. Tulkinghorn, not to anybody else."
"Why, he paid you for them, you know, and handsome too," says Mr. Bucket.
"I don't care for that. I want to know who's got 'em. And I'll tell you what we want, what we all here want, Mr. Bucket. We want more painstaking and search-making into this murder. We know where the interest and the motive was, and you have not done enough. If George the Vagabond Dragoon had any hand in it, he was only an accomplice and was set on. You know what I mean as well as any man."
"Now, I'll tell you what," says Mr. Bucket,
instantaneously altering his manner, coming close to him and communicating an extraordinary fascination to the forefinger. "I'm damned if I'm a-going to have my case spoilt or interfered with or anticipated by so much as half a second of time by any human being in creation. You want more painstaking and search-making. You do. Do you see this hand? And do you think that I don't know the right time to stretch it out and put it on the arm that fired that shot?" Such is the dread power of the man, and so terribly evident it is that he makes no idle boast, that Mr. Smallweed begins to apologize. Mr. Bucket, dismissing his sudden anger, checks him.
"The advice I give you is, don't trouble your head about the murder. That's my affair. You keep half an eye on the newspapers, and I shouldn't wonder if you was to read something about it before long, if you look sharp. I know my business, and that's all I've got to say to you on that subject. Now, about those letters. You want to know who's got 'em? I don't mind telling you. I have got 'em. Is that the packet?"
Mr. Smallweed looks with greedy eyes at the little bundle Mr. Bucket produces from a mysterious part of his coat, and identifies it as the same.
"What have you got to say next?" asks Mr. Bucket. "Now don't open your mouth too wide, because you don't look handsome when you do it."
"I want £500."
"No, you don't. You mean 50," says Mr. Bucket humorously.
It appears, however, that Mr. Smallweed means 500.
"That is, I am deputed by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, to consider, without admitting or promising anything, this bit of business," says Mr. Bucket. Sir Leicester mechanically bows his head. "And you ask me to consider a proposal of £500. Why, it's an unreasonable proposal. 250 will be bad enough, but better than that. Hadn't you better say 250?
Mr. Smallweed is quite clear that he had better not.
"Then," says Mr. Bucket, "let's hear Mr. Chadband. Lord, many a time have heard my old fellow sergeant of that name, and a moderate man he was in all respects, as ever I come across."
Thus invited, Mr. Chadband steps forth, and after a little sleek smiling and a little oil-grinding with the palms of his hands, delivers himself as follows.
"My friends, we are now, Rachel, my wife and I, in the mansions of the rich and great. Why are we now in the mansions of the rich and great, my friends? Is it because we are invited? Because we are bidden to feast with them, because we are bidden to rejoice with them, because we are bidden to play the lute with them, because we are bidden to dance with them? No. Then why are we here, my friends? Are we in possession of a sinful secret, and do we require corn and wine and oil, and what is much the same thing, money for the keeping thereof? Probably so, my friends."
"You're a man of business, you are. returns Mr. Bucket, very attentive, "and consequently you're going on to mention what the nature of your secret is. You're right, you couldn't do better. Let us then, my brother, in a spirit of love," says Mr. Chadband, with a cunning eye, "proceed unto it. Rachel, my wife, advance." Mrs. Chadband, more than ready, so advances as to jostle her husband into the background, and confronts Mr. Bucket with a hard, frowning smile. "Since you want to know what we know," says she, "I'll tell you. I helped to bring up Miss Horden, her ladyship's daughter. I was in the service of her ladyship's sister, who was very sensitive to the disgrace her ladyship brought upon her, and gave out, even to her ladyship, that the child was dead. She was very nearly so when she was born. But she's alive, and I know her." With these words and a laugh, and laying a bitter stress on the word ladyship, Mrs. Chadband folds her arms and looks implacably at Mr. Bucket. "I suppose now," returns that officer, "you will be expecting a £20 note or a present of about that figure." Mrs. Chadband merely laughs, and contemptuously tells him he can offer 20 pence. "My friend the law stationer's good lady over there," says Mr. Bucket, luring Mrs. Snagsby forward with the finger. "What may your game be, ma'am?" Mrs. Snagsby is at first prevented, by tears and lamentations, from stating the nature of her game, but by degrees it confusedly comes to light that she is a woman overwhelmed with injuries and wrongs, whom Mr. Snagsby has habitually deceived, abandoned, and sought to keep in darkness, and whose chief comfort under her afflictions has been the sympathy of the late Mr. Tulkinghorn, who showed so much commiseration for her on one occasion of his calling in Cook's Court in the absence of her perjured husband, that she has of late habitually carried to him all her woes. Everybody, it appears, the present company excepted, has plotted against Mrs. Snagsby's peace. There is Mr. Guppy, clerk to Kenge and Carboy, who was at first as open as the sun at noon, but who suddenly shut up as close as midnight, under the influence, no doubt, of Mr. Snagsby's suborning and tampering. There is Mr. Weevil, friend of Mr. Guppy, who lived mysteriously up a court owing to the like coherent causes. There was Crook, deceased. There was Nimrod, deceased. And there was Joe, deceased. And they were all in it. In what, Mrs. Snagsby does not with particularity express, but she knows that Joe was Mr. Snagsby's son, as well as if a trumpet had spoken it. And she followed Mr. Snagsby when he went on his last visit to the boy, and if he was not his son, why did he go? The one occupation of her life has been, for some time back, to follow Mr. Snagsby to and fro and up and down, and to piece suspicious circumstances together, and every circumstance that has happened has been most suspicious. And in this way she has pursued her object of detecting and confounding her false husband night and day. Thus did it come to pass that she brought the Chadbands and Mr. Tulkinghorn together, and conferred with Mr. Tulkinghorn on the change in Mr. Guppy, and helped to turn up the circumstances in which the present company are interested, casually, by the wayside, being still and ever on the great high road that is to terminate in Mr. Snagsby's full exposure and a matrimonial separation. All this, Mrs. Snagsby, as an injured woman, and the friend of Mrs. Chadband, and the follower of Mr. Chadband, and the mourner of the late Mr. Tulkinghorn, is here to certify under the seal of confidence, with every possible confusion and involvement possible and impossible, having no pecuniary motive whatever, no scheme or project but the one mentioned, and bringing here and taking everywhere her own dense atmosphere of dust arising from the ceaseless working of her mill of jealousy. While this exordium is in hand, and it takes some time, Mr. Bucket, who has seen through the transparency of Mrs. Snagsby's vinegar at a glance, confers with his familiar demon, and bestows his shrewd attention on the Chadbands and Mr. Smallweed. Sir Leicester Dedlock remains immovable, with the same icy surface upon him, except that he once or twice looks towards Mr. Bucket, as relying on that officer alone of all mankind. "Very good," says Mr. Bucket. "Now I understand you, you know, and being deputed by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, to look into this little matter," again Sir Leicester mechanically bows in confirmation of the statement, "can give it my fair and full attention. Now I won't allude to conspiring to extort money or anything of that sort, because we are men and women of the world here, and our object is to make things pleasant. But I tell you what I do wonder at. I'm surprised that you should think of making a noise below in the hall. It was so opposed to your interests. That's what I look at."
"We wanted to get in," pleads Mr. Smallweed.
"Why, of course you wanted to get in," Mr. Bucket asserts with cheerfulness. "But for an old gentleman at your time of life, what I call truly venerable, mind you, with his wits sharpened, as I have no doubt they are, by the loss of the use of his limbs, which occasions all his animation to mount up into his head, not to consider that if he don't keep such a business as the present as close as possible, it can't be worth a mag to him, is so curious. You see, your temper got the better of you. That's where you lost ground," says Mr. Bucket, in an argumentative and friendly way. "I only said I wouldn't go without one of the servants came up to Sir Leicester Dedlock," returns Mr. Smallweed. "That's it. That's where your temper got the better of you. Now you keep it under another time, and you'll make money by it. Shall I ring for them to carry you down?"
"When are we to hear more of this?"
Mrs. Chadband sternly demands. "Bless your heart for a true woman. Always curious, your delightful sex is," replies Mr. Bucket with gallantry. "I shall have the pleasure of giving you a call tomorrow or next day, not forgetting Mr. Smallweed and his proposal of 250.
500!
Exclaims Mr. Smallweed. "All right. Nominally 500. Mr. Bucket has his hand on the bell rope. "Shall I wish you good day for the present on the part of myself and the gentlemen of the house?" he asks in an insinuating tone. Nobody having the hardihood to object to his doing so, he does it, and the party retire as they came up. Mr. Bucket follows them to the door, and returning, says with an air of serious business, "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, it's for you to consider whether or not to buy this up. I should recommend, on the whole, its being bought up myself. I think it may be bought pretty cheap. You see, that little pickled cowcumber of a Mrs. Snagsby has been used by all sides of the speculation, and has done a deal more harm in bringing odds and ends together than if she had meant it. Mr. Tulkinghorn, deceased, he held all these horses in his hand, and could have drove them his own way, I haven't a doubt. But he was fetched off the box head foremost, and now they've got their legs over the traces, and are all dragging and pulling their own ways. So it is, and such is life. The cat's away, and the mice they play. The frost breaks up, and the water runs. Now, with regard to the party to be apprehended." Sir Leicester seems to wake, though his eyes have been wide open, and he looks intently at Mr. Bucket as Mr. Bucket refers to his watch. "The party to be apprehended is now in this house," proceeds Mr. Bucket, putting up his watch with a steady hand and with rising spirits, "and I'm about to take her into custody in your presence. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, don't you say a word, nor yet stir. There'll be no noise, and no disturbance at all. I'll come back in the course of the evening, if agreeable to you, and endeavour to meet your wishes respecting this unfortunate family matter, and the nobbiest way of keeping it quiet. Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, don't you be nervous on account of the apprehension at present coming off. You shall see the whole case clear from first to last." Mr. Bucket rings, goes to the door, briefly whispers Mercury, shuts the door, and stands behind it with his arms folded. After a suspense of a minute or two, the door slowly opens, and a Frenchwoman enters, Mademoiselle Hortense. The moment she is in the room, Mr. Bucket claps the door to and puts his back against it. The suddenness of the noise occasions her to turn, and then, for the first time, she sees Sir Leicester Dedlock in his chair.
"I ask your pardon," she mutters hurriedly. "They tell me there was no one here."
Her step towards the door brings her front to front with Mr. Bucket. Suddenly a spasm shoots across her face, and she turns deadly pale. "This is my lodger, Sir Leicester Dedlock," says Mr. Bucket, nodding at her. "This foreign young woman has been my lodger for some weeks back."
"What do Sir Leicester care for that, you think, my angel?" returns Mademoiselle in a jocular strain.
"Why, my angel," returns Mr. Bucket, "we shall see." Mademoiselle Hortense eyes him with a scowl upon her tight face, which gradually changes into a smile of scorn.
"You are very mysterious. Are you drunk?"
"Tolerably sober, my angel," returns Mr. Bucket.
"I come from arriving at this so detestable house with your wife. Your wife have left me since some minutes. They tell me downstairs that your wife is here. I come here, and your wife is not here. What is the intention of this fool's play, say then?"
Mademoiselle demands, with her arms composedly crossed, but with something in her dark cheek beating like a clock. Mr. Bucket merely shakes the finger at her.
"Ah, my God, you are an unhappy idiot," cries Mademoiselle, with a toss of her head and a laugh. "Leave me to pass downstairs, great pig,"
with a stamp of her foot and a menace.
"Now, mademoiselle,"
says Mr. Bucket in a cool, determined way. "You go and sit down upon that sofy."
"I will not sit down upon nothing," she replies, with a shower of nods.
"Now, mademoiselle," repeats Mr. Bucket, making no demonstration except with the finger, "you sit down upon that sofy."
"Why?"
"Because I take you into custody on a charge of murder, and you don't need to be told it. I want to be polite to one of your sex and a foreigner, if I can. If I can't, I must be rough, and there's rougher ones outside. What I am to be depends on you. So I recommend you, as a friend, afore another half a blessed moment has passed over your head, to go and sit down upon that sofy." Mademoiselle complies, saying in a concentrated voice, while that something in her cheek beats fast and hard,
"You are a devil."
"Now, you see," Mr. Bucket proceeds approvingly, "you're comfortable, and conducting yourself as I should expect a foreign young woman of your sense to do. So I'll give you a piece of advice, and it's this. Don't you talk too much. You're not expected to say anything here, and you can't keep too quiet a tongue in your head. In short, the less you parley, the better, you know." Mr. Bucket is very complacent over this French explanation. Mademoiselle, with that tigerish expansion of the mouth and her black eyes darting fire upon him, sits upright on the sofa in a rigid state with her hands clenched, and her feet, too, one might suppose, muttering,
"Oh, you Bucket, you are a devil."
"Now, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," says Mr. Bucket, and from this time forth the finger never rests, "this young woman, my lodger, was her ladyship's maid at the time I have mentioned to you, and this young woman, besides being extraordinary vehement and passionate against her ladyship after being discharged—"
"Lie!" cries Mademoiselle. "I discharge myself."
"Now, why don't you take my advice?" returns Mr. Bucket, in an impressive, almost in an imploring tone. "I'm surprised at the indiscreetness you commit. You'll say something that'll be used against you, you know. You're sure to come to it. Never you mind what I say till it's given in evidence. It is not addressed to you."
"Discharged, too," cries Mademoiselle furiously, "by her ladyship. Eh, my faith, a pretty ladyship. Why, I ruin my character by remaining with a ladyship so infirm."
"Upon my soul, I wonder at you," Mr. Bucket remonstrates. "I thought the French were a polite nation, I did, really. Yet to hear a female going on like that before Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet—"
"He is a poor abused," cries Mademoiselle. "I spit upon his house, upon his name, upon his imbecility."
All of which she makes the carpet represent.
"Oh, that he is a great man. Oh, yes, superb. Oh, heaven, bah!"
"Well, Sir Leicester Dedlock," proceeds Mr. Bucket, "this intemperate foreigner also angrily took it into her head that she had established a claim upon Mr. Tulkinghorn, deceased, by attending on the occasion I told you of at his chambers, though she was liberally paid for her time and trouble."
"Lie!" cries Mademoiselle. "I refuse his money altogether."
"If you will parley, you know," says Mr. Bucket, parenthetically, "you must take the consequences. Now, whether she became my lodger, Sir Leicester Dedlock, with any deliberate intention then of doing this deed and blinding me, I give no opinion on. But she lived in my house in that capacity at the time that she was hovering about the chambers of the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn, with a view to a wrangle, and likewise persecuting and half-frightening life out of an unfortunate stationer."
"Lie!" cries Mademoiselle. "All lie!"
"The murder was committed, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and you know under what circumstances. Now I beg of you to follow me close with your attention for a minute or two. I was sent for, and the case was entrusted to me. I examined the place, and the body, and the papers, and everything. From information I received, from a clerk in the same house, I took George into custody as having been seen hanging about there on the night, and at very nigh the time of the murder, also as having been overheard in high words with the deceased on former occasions, even threatening him, as the witness made out. If you ask me, Sir Leicester Dedlock, whether from the first I believe George to be the murderer, I tell you candidly, no. But he might be, notwithstanding, and there was enough against him to make it my duty to take him and get him kept under remand. Now, observe." As Mr. Bucket bends forward in some excitement, for him, and inaugurates what he is going to say with one ghostly beat of his forefinger in the air, Mademoiselle Hortense fixes her black eyes upon him with a dark frown, and sets her dry lips closely and firmly together. "I went home, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, at night, and found this young woman having supper with my wife, Mrs. Bucket. She had made a mighty show of being fond of Mrs. Bucket, from her first offering herself as our lodger. But that night she made more than ever,
in fact, overdid it. Likewise, she overdid her respect and all that for the lamented memory of the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn. By the living Lord, it flashed upon me, as I sat opposite to her at the table, and saw her with a knife in her hand, that she had done it. Mademoiselle is hardly audible in straining through her teeth and lips the words,
"You are a devil."
Now where, pursues Mr. Bucket, had she been on the night of the murder? She had been to the theatre. She really was there, I've since found, both before the deed and after it. I knew I had an artful customer to deal with, and that proof would be very difficult, and I laid a trap for her. Such a trap as I never laid yet, and such a venture as I never made yet. I worked it out in my mind while I was talking to her at supper. When I went upstairs to bed, our house being small and this young woman's ears sharp, I stuffed the sheet into Mrs. Bucket's mouth that she shouldn't say a word of surprise, and told her all about it. My dear, don't you give your mind to that again, or I shall link your feet together at the ankles. Mr. Bucket, breaking off, has made a noiseless descent upon Mademoiselle, and laid his heavy hand upon her shoulder.
"What is the matter with you now?"
she asks him. "Don't you think any more," returns Mr. Bucket with admonitory finger, "of throwing yourself out of window? That's what's the matter with me. Come, just take my arm. You needn't get up. I'll sit down by you. Now take my arm, will you? I'm a married man, you know. You're acquainted with my wife. Just take my arm." Vainly endeavouring to moisten those dry lips, with a painful sound she struggles with herself and complies. Now we're all right again. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, this case could never have been the case it is but for Mrs. Bucket, who is a woman in 50,000, in 150,000. To throw this young woman off her guard, I've never set foot in our house since, though I've communicated with Mrs. Bucket in the baker's loaves and in the milk as often as required. My whispered words to Mrs. Bucket when she had the sheet in her mouth were, "My dear, can you throw her off continually with natural accounts of my suspicions against George, and this and that and t'other? Can you do without rest and keep watch upon her night and day? Can you undertake to say, 'She shall do nothing without my knowledge, she shall be my prisoner without suspecting it, she shall no more escape from me than from death, and her life shall be my life, and her soul my soul, till I have got her if she did this murder?' Mrs. Bucket says to me, as well as she could speak on account of the sheet, 'Bucket, I can,' and she has acted up to it glorious."
"Lies,"
Mademoiselle interposes.
"All lies, my friend."
"Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, how did my calculations come out under these circumstances? When I calculated that this impetuous young woman would overdo it in new directions, was I wrong or right?" "I was right." "What does she try to do? Don't let it give you a turn. To throw the murder on her ladyship." Sir Leicester rises from his chair and staggers down again. "And she got encouragement in it from hearing that I was always here, which was done a purpose. Now, open that pocket-book of mine, Sir Leicester Dedlock, if I may take the liberty of throwing it towards you, and look at the letters sent to me, each with the two words, 'Lady Dedlock,' in it. Open the one directed to yourself, which I stopped this very morning, and read the three words, 'Lady Dedlock, murderess,' in it. These letters have been falling about like a shower of ladybirds. What do you say now to Mrs. Bucket from her spy place, having seen them all written by this young woman? What do you say to Mrs. Bucket, having, within this half hour, secured the corresponding ink and paper, fellow half-sheets and what not? What do you say to Mrs. Bucket, having watched the posting of 'em every one by this young woman, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet?" Mr. Bucket asks, triumphant in his admiration of his lady's genius. Two things are especially observable as Mr. Bucket proceeds to a conclusion. First, that he seems imperceptibly to establish a dreadful right of property in Mademoiselle. Secondly, that the very atmosphere she breathes seems to narrow and contract about her, as if a close net or a pall were being drawn nearer and yet nearer around her breathless figure. "There is no doubt that her ladyship was on the spot at the eventful period," says Mr. Bucket, "and my foreign friend here saw her, I believe, from the upper part of the staircase. Her ladyship and George and my foreign friend were all pretty close on one another's heels. But that don't signify any more, so I'll not go into it. I found the wadding of the pistol with which the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn was shot. It was a bit of the printed description of your house at Chesney Wold. Not much in that, you'll say, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet? No, but when my foreign friend here is so thoroughly off her guard as to think it a safe time to tear up the rest of that leaf, and when Mrs. Bucket puts the pieces together and finds the wadding wanting, it begins to look like Queer Street."
"These are very long lies," Mademoiselle interposes. "You prose great deal. Is it that you have almost all finished, or are you speaking always?
Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, proceeds Mr. Bucket, who delights in a full title and does violence to himself when he dispenses with any fragment of it. The last point in the case, which I'm now going to mention, shows the necessity of patience in our business and never doing a thing in a hurry. I watched this young woman yesterday without her knowledge when she was looking at the funeral in company with my wife, who planned to take her there, and I had so much to convict her, and I saw such an expression in her face, and my mind so rose against her malice towards her ladyship, and the time was altogether such a time for bringing down what you may call retribution upon her, that if I had been a younger hand with less experience, I should have taken her, certain. Equally, last night, when her ladyship, as is so universally admired, I'm sure, come home looking, why, Lord, a man might almost say like Venus rising from the ocean, it was so unpleasant and inconsistent to think of her being charged with a murder of which she was innocent, that I felt quite to want to put an end to the job. What should I have lost? Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I should have lost the weapon. My prisoner here proposed to Mrs. Bucket, after the departure of the funeral, that they should go per bus a little ways into the country and take tea at a very decent house of entertainment. Now, near that house of entertainment there's a piece of water. At tea my prisoner got up to fetch her pocket handkerchief from the bedroom where the bonnets was. She was rather a long time gone, and came back a little out of wind. As soon as they came home, this was reported to me by Mrs. Bucket, along with her observations and suspicions. I had the piece of water dragged by moonlight, in presence of a couple of our men, and a pocket pistol was brought up before it had been there half a dozen hours. Now, my dear, put your arm a little further through mine, and hold it steady, and I shan't hurt you. In a trice, Mr. Bucket snaps a handcuff on her wrist. "That's one," says Mr. Bucket. "Now the other, darling, two and all told." He rises. She rises, too. "Where?" she asks him, darkening her large eyes until their drooping lids almost conceal them, and yet they stare. "Where is your false, your treacherous and cursed wife?"
"She's gone forward to the police office," returns Mr. Bucket. "You'll see her there, my dear."
"I would like to kiss her,"
exclaims Mademoiselle Hortense, panting tigress-like.
"You'd bite her, I suspect," says Mr. Bucket.
"I would," making her eyes very large. "I would love to tear her limb from limb."
"Bless you, darling," says Mr. Bucket, with the greatest composure. "I'm fully prepared to hear that. Your sex have such a surprising animosity against one another when you do differ. You don't mind me half so much, do you?"
"No, though you are a devil still."
"Angel and devil by turns, eh?" cries Mr. Bucket. "But I am in my regular employment, you must consider. Let me put your shawl tidy. I've been lady's maid to a good many before now. Anything wanting to the bonnet? There's a cab at the door."
Mademoiselle Hortense, casting an indignant eye at the glass, shakes herself perfectly neat in one shake and looks, to do her justice, uncommonly genteel.
"Listen, then, my angel," says she, after several sarcastic nods. "You are very spiritual, but can you restore him back to life?"
Mr. Bucket answers, "Not exactly."
"That is droll. Listen yet one time. You are very spiritual. Can you make a honourable lady of her?"
"Don't be so malicious," says Mr. Bucket.
"Or a haughty gentleman of him?"
cries Mademoiselle, referring to Sir Leicester with ineffable disdain.
"Eh! Oh, then regard him, the poor infant. Ha, ha, ha!"
"Come, come, why, this is worse parleying than the other," says Mr. Bucket. "Come along."
"You cannot do these things?"
"Then you can do as you please with me. It is but the death, it is all the same.
Let us go, my angel. Adieu, you old man grey. I pity you, and I despise you."
With these last words, she snaps her teeth together as if her mouth closed with a spring. It is impossible to describe how Mr. Bucket gets her out, but he accomplishes that feat in a manner so peculiar to himself, enfolding and pervading her like a cloud, and hovering away with her as if he were a homely Jupiter and she the object of his affections. Sir Leicester, left alone, remains in the same attitude, as though he were still listening and his attention were still occupied. At length he gazes round the empty room, and finding it deserted, rises unsteadily to his feet, pushes back his chair, and walks a few steps, supporting himself by the table. Then he stops, and with more of those inarticulate sounds, lifts up his eyes and seems to stare at something. never knows what he sees. The green woods of Chesney Wold, the noble house, the pictures of his forefathers, strangers defacing them, officers of police coarsely handling his most precious heirlooms, thousands of fingers pointing at him, thousands of faces sneering at him. But if such shadows flit before him to his bewilderment, there is one other shadow which he can name with something like distinctness even yet, and to which alone he addresses his tearing of his white hair and his extended arms. It is she, in association with whom, saving that she has been for years a main fibre of the root of his dignity and pride, he has never had a selfish thought. It is she whom he has loved, admired, honoured, and set up for the world to respect. It is she who, at the core of all the constrained formalities and conventionalities of his life, has been a stock of living tenderness and love, susceptible as nothing else is of being struck with the agony he feels. He sees her almost to the exclusion of himself, and cannot bear to look upon her cast down from the high place she has graced so well. And even to the point of his sinking on the ground, oblivious of his suffering, he can yet pronounce her name with something like distinctness in the midst of those intrusive sounds, and in a tone of mourning and compassion rather than reproach. Chapter 55. Flight. Inspector Bucket, of the detective, has not yet struck his great blow, as just now chronicled, but is yet refreshing himself with sleep, preparatory to his field day, when through the night and along the freezing wintry roads a chaise and pair comes out of Lincolnshire, making its way towards London. Railroads shall soon traverse all this country, and with a rattle and a glare the engine and train shall shoot like a meteor over the wide night landscape, turning the moon paler. But as yet such things are non-existent in these parts, though not wholly unexpected. Preparations are afoot, measurements are made, ground is staked out, bridges are begun, and their not yet united piers desolately look at one another over roads and streams, like brick and mortar couples with an obstacle to their union. Fragments of embankments are thrown up and left as precipices, with torrents of rusty carts and barrows tumbling over them. Tripods of tall poles appear on hilltops, where there are rumours of tunnels. Everything looks chaotic and abandoned in full hopelessness. Along the freezing roads and through the night, the post-chaise makes its way without a railroad on its mind. Mrs. Rouncewell, so many years housekeeper at Chesney Wold, sits within the chaise, and by her side sits Mrs. Bagnet, with her grey cloak and umbrella. The old girl would prefer the bar in front, as being exposed to the weather and a primitive sort of perch more in accordance with her usual course of travelling, but Mrs. Rouncewell is too thoughtful of her comfort to admit of her proposing it. The old lady cannot make enough of the old girl. She sits in her stately manner, holding her hand, and regardless of its roughness, puts it often to her lips.
"You are a mother, my dear soul," says she many times, "and you found out my George's mother."
"Why, George," returns Mrs. Bagnet, "was always free with me, ma'am, and when he said at our house to my Woolwich that of all the things my Woolwich could have to think of when he grew to be a man, the comfortablest would be that he had never brought a sorrowful line into his mother's face, or turned a hair of her head grey, then I felt sure from his way that something fresh had brought his own mother into his mind. I had often known him say to me in past times that he had behaved bad to her."
"Never, my dear," returns Mrs. Rouncewell, bursting into tears. "My blessing on him, never. He was always fond of me, and loving to me was my George. But he had a bold spirit, and he ran a little wild and went for a soldier. And I know he waited at first, in letting us know about himself, till he should rise to be an officer. And when he didn't rise, I know he considered himself beneath us, and wouldn't be a disgrace to us, for he had a lion heart, had my George, always from a baby."
The old lady's hands stray about her as of yore, while she recalls, all in a tremble, what a likely lad, what a fine lad, what a gay, good-humoured, clever lad he was, how they all took to him down at Chesney Wold, how Sir Leicester took to him when he was a young gentleman, how the dogs took to him, how even the people who had been angry with him forgave him the moment he was gone, poor boy. And now to see him after all, and in a prison, too, and the broad stomacher heaves, and the quaint, upright, old-fashioned figure bends under its load of affectionate distress. Mrs. Bagnet, with the instinctive skill of a good warm heart, leaves the old housekeeper to her emotions for a little while, not without passing the back of her hand across her own motherly eyes,
and presently chirps up in a cheery manner. So I says to George, when I goes to call him in to tea, he pretended to be smoking his pipe outside, "What ails you this afternoon, George, for gracious sake? I've seen all sorts, and I've seen you pretty often in season and out of season, abroad and at home, and I never see you so melancholy penitent." "Why, Mrs. Bagnet," says George, "it's because I am melancholy and penitent both this afternoon that you see me so." "What have you done, old fellow?" I says. "Why, Mrs. Bagnet," says George, shaking his head, "what I have done has been done this many a long year, and is best not tried to be undone now. If I ever get to heaven, it won't be for being a good son to a widowed mother. I say no more. Now, ma'am, when George says to me that it's best not tried to be undone now, I have my thoughts as I have often had before, and I draw it out of George how he comes to have such things on him that afternoon. Then George tells me that he has seen by chance at the lawyer's office a fine old lady that has brought his mother plain before him, and he runs on about that old lady till he quite forgets himself, and paints her picture to me as she used to be years upon years back. So I says to George, when he's done, who is this old lady he has seen? And George tells me it's Mrs. Rouncewell, housekeeper for more than half a century to the Dedlock family down at Chesney Wold in Lincolnshire. George has frequently told me before that he's a Lincolnshire man, and I says to my old Lignum that night, 'Lignum, that's his mother, for 5 and 40 pound.' All this Mrs. Bagnet now relates for the 20th time at least within the last 4 hours, trilling it out like a kind of bird with a pretty high note that it may be audible to the old lady above the hum of the wheels. 'Bless you, and thank you,' says Mrs. Rouncewell. 'Bless you, and thank you, my worthy soul.' 'Dear heart,' cries Mrs. Bagnet in the most natural manner, 'no thanks to me, I'm sure. Thanks to yourself, ma'am, for being so ready to pay him. And mind once more, ma'am, what you had best do on finding George to be your own son is to make him, for your sake, have every sort of help to put himself in the right and clear himself of the charge of which he is as innocent as you or me. It won't do to have truth and justice on his side. He must have law and lawyers,' exclaimed the old girl, apparently persuaded that the latter form a separate establishment and have dissolved partnership with truth and justice for ever and a day. "'He shall have,' says Mrs. Rouncewell, 'all the help that can be got for him in the world, my dear. I will spend all I have, and thankfully, to procure it. Sir Leicester will do his best. The whole family will do their best. I know something, my dear, and will make my own appeal, as his mother parted from him all these years, and finding him in a jail at last.' The extreme disquietude of the old housekeeper's manner in saying this, her broken words and her wringing of her hands, make a powerful impression on Mrs. Bagnet, and would astonish her but that she refers them all to her sorrow for her son's condition. And yet Mrs. Bagnet wonders, too, why Mrs. Rouncewell should murmur so distractedly, "My lady, my lady, my lady," over and over again. The frosty night wears away, and the dawn breaks, and the post-chaise comes rolling on through the early mist like the ghost of a chaise departed. It has plenty of spectral company in ghosts of trees and hedges, slowly vanishing and giving place to the realities of the day. London reached, the travellers alight. The old housekeeper in great tribulation and confusion, Mrs. Bagnet quite fresh and collected, as she would be if her next point, with no new equipage and outfit, were the Cape of Good Hope, the Island of Ascension, Hong Kong, or any other military station. But when they set out for the prison, where the trooper is confined, the old lady has managed to draw about her, with her lavender-coloured dress, much of the staid calmness which is its usual accompaniment. A wonderfully grave, precise, and handsome piece of old china she looks, though her heart beats fast, and her stomacher is ruffled more than even the remembrance of this wayward son has ruffled it these many years. Approaching the cell, they find the door opening, and a warder in the act of coming out. The old girl promptly makes a sign of entreaty to him to say nothing. Assenting with a nod, he suffers them to enter as he shuts the door. So George, who is writing at his table, supposing himself to be alone, does not raise his eyes, but remains absorbed. The old housekeeper looks at him, and those wandering hands of hers are quite enough for Mrs. Bagnet's confirmation, even if she could see the mother and the son together, knowing what she knows, and doubt their relationship. Not a rustle of the housekeeper's dress, not a gesture, not a word betrays her. She stands looking at him as he writes on, all unconscious, and only her fluttering hands give utterance to her emotions. But they are very eloquent, very, very eloquent. Mrs. Bagnet understands them. They speak of gratitude, of joy, of grief,
of hope, of inextinguishable affection, cherished with no return since this stalwart man was a stripling, of a better son loved less, and this son loved so fondly and so proudly. And they speak in such touching language that Mrs. Bagnet's eyes brim up with tears, and they run glistening down her son's brown face.
"George Rouncewell, oh, my dear child, turn and look at me."
The trooper starts up, clasps his mother round the neck, and falls down on his knees before her. Whether in a late repentance, whether in the first association that comes back upon him, he puts his hands together as a child does when it says its prayers, and raising them towards her breast, bows down his head and cries,
"My George, my dearest son, always my favourite and my favourite still, where have you been these cruel years and years? Grown such a